Hi, everybody. Welcome. So, this is kind of a cool class that I got to put together. And last time and a couple times I've done conferences, it's just been me talking. And I know these guys have done that a time or two. And it gets a little boring. And so I wanted to kind of get more of a flavor of all the personalities and skill sets up here. And all these guys have done many mixing jobs in their own right. And I will introduce them here. The guy on the end, his name is Ryan Krause. Me and him go back about 20 years. He came out and ran sound for the rock band I was in. And from that point, pulled me over to the dark side of mixing, and I never left it. And he works at Grace Church St. Louis.
Yeah.
I almost said it wrong. I almost said my old church. And got Tim Corder here. Met Tim first when he was mixing at Kensington over in Detroit. And now it's Life Church, right?
New Life Church.
New Life Church in Arkansas. And they just got done with a big event called Decade at the Verizon Arena, if I'm correct. So he's fresh off a big arena gig. Hopefully we get to hear some of that. And David Stagel from North Point, Andy Stanley's church. Ta-da. Sitting here next to me. So again, I put these guys together because I wanted to hear their professional opinion on stuff. And I promise that I'm going to pull up the right questions this time and not ask a musician about sound stuff.
You had our questions up at the last one.
I know. That was brilliant. So what do you think about it? Wait, you're not an audio guy. Okay. So the title of this class is Mixing is an Art. It's not a plug-in. And that title came from some of the things I was seeing out there that a lot of, I'll have to just say, some of the younger engineers were chasing the black box or the piece of gear to make their mix work and sound pristine. And but I'm here to tell you that if you can't get it on a Mackie or some lesser console, you go up to the bigger stuff, it's worse. So there's just some basic stuff that you gotta have. And I kind of formatted some of these questions, and I know these guys are going to give some great answers and just help us talk about the art of mixing, and that's what this is about. And gear is a part of it, but I don't want you to think that the gear is what's going to make you better. So let's get started here, and I want to start with Dave here. The first question was, tell us a little about your background and why you became an audio engineer.
Well, I got wow, this is loud.
You're hot.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Like, you know, coming up to Chicago, I'm like, hey, it's freezing up there, but I get to wear my flannel shirts. So, I got started doing sound stuff in high school. I actually originally wanted to be a lighting guy, which it probably turned out that that didn't happen because, you know, it's like a friend of mine likes to say, I respect heights. So, I got started doing stuff in high school, doing musicals and theater and just that kind of stuff, being the sound geek. And then I went to film school, and while I was there, I was like one of the only guys who it seemed like had any kind of audio background at all. So I used to have a lot of things kind of pushed in my direction to do sound, and at some point I just finally said, okay, I get it. Maybe the audio thing is for me, and I ended up really just focusing on it, getting passionate about it. Interned in recording studios in college and worked with bands, and I was playing in my own band for, I don't know, maybe 10 years doing clubs and stuff like that. And then when I got out of school, I was doing a lot of kind of industrial stuff and post-related stuff. I mixed some stuff for cable TV and just some other broadcast stuff. Audiobooks, voiceovers, just about all that stuff. And then, I guess it was about 7 years ago or so, I got into doing church sound. The drummer in my band had invited me to his church, and he'd been inviting me for probably a year, and I finally gave in. And I just came there, and I was just volunteering, playing in the band, and somebody found out that I was a professional audio engineer, and they lured me into coming on staff, and I was there for a couple of years on staff, and then I moved down to North Point, and I've been there about 5 years now, I guess. So.
Awesome. Tim?
My background's probably pretty similar. I started as a kid, you know, I kind of grew up around it. My dad
sang in a Southern Gospel Quartet as I was growing up, and so I grew up around, they were just part-time, but they'd go out a couple of weekends a month, and so literally, there's pictures of me when I was 4 or 5 years old, wrapping cables and learning to, run a real simple PA. As I got older, got the chance to start doing some studio stuff. This was right in the early days of home studio recording, when all of a sudden, we have the ability to have an 8-track, Fostex reel-to-reel, and then Tascam DA 38s and 88s and stuff like that. So through high school, I was doing engineering and producing records, and then went to college. My passion was to do live production. I've always kind of felt like that was just the place where I really fit. But my parents wanted me to have a real job, so I went to school and for a business degree. And the last, going into my senior year, I found out about a job at Cedar Point in an amusement park up in, over in Ohio. Down south, nobody knows about Cedar Point. Up here, hopefully you guys do. So I worked for a summer as a stage manager, audio, lighting, video, basically running the whole thing for one of the live shows, managing, it was probably a 6 or 7 piece band and some vocals, and we did 600 some shows over that summer. It was the best job I'd ever had because it really made you have to learn to deal with repetition, which, I didn't know then, but God's preparing for working in a church and doing 4 or 12 or 14 holiday services. Through that, I met some guys in Nashville and actually had the opportunity. I left school with a semester to go, moved to Nashville, and for 3 years did the kind of the touring thing, started out. But it was pretty cool how God opened those doors because I had the chance to go down and really, really have impact rather than starting out at the ground floor. I did that for 3 years, and at the end of that was pretty just ready for change and missing home. And single, and so I moved back home, and for about a year and a half, got away from production completely, married my college sweetheart, and we've been married about maybe a year or so, and I found out about this job at Kensington. Kensington had been really influential in my life as in college. Kensington is a seeker-driven, very presentational weekends. I'd never heard rock and roll on the weekends. I'd never seen the production level that I saw at Kensington in church, and it really blew me away. Fast forward there, it was 4 or 5 years later after I first walked in the door at Kensington. I joined their staff as their audio engineer, and then over time grew to be the audio director and start leading some other guys around other campuses and really start having to look at repeatability and the ability to do the same service with lots of different people, and it was some of the best professional experience of my life. Last summer, God called us away from Kensington to New Life Church in Arkansas. Arkansas was not on my 10-year plan at all. Everybody looked at me crazy when you're moving to Arkansas. New Life Church is an incredible place, and Scott just mentioned we just did 2 weeks ago our 10th anniversary service in Verizon Arena. God has taken and multiplied what was a 14 by 20 foot living room 10 years ago to a little over 13,000 people that were there for that event, and it was incredible. So that was a really special experience. Now my job at New Life is, I've gone from really being a staff engineer who was mixing the majority. I was probably mixing 6 or 7 of the 8 or 9 services a week, a month. Now I'm leading volunteers. I have a full-time assistant who works with me, and my official title is production manager. I'm leading audio, video, lighting, stage, all the volunteers, and really, shifting from the craft of doing it for myself to now trying to coach other guys and grow, a lot of young guys especially, and help them do great mixes week to week. So that's my journey.
So if you want to learn audio, move to Arkansas and get an attention. Go ahead, Ron.
Okay, well, I was in a band in high school, totally into the drum thing, but we needed a sound system, so I scraped together some gear and was the only one that knew how to set it up and use it, so ended up becoming the sound guy by default. And I didn't know what I was going to do for college. My mom actually was like, go to Millikan University, you can do studio, you can do music, you can do computers, all the things I was interested in. So I went there, and 1 year I'd spend really focusing on the drums, the next year I'd spend focusing on the studio. And through that time, for the summers, I happened on a local sound company that happened to be pretty big in the region, doing large state fairs and bigger outdoor events, kind of the Mud and Dust Tour type thing. So I got on with them every summer while I was in school. And the music thing was working a little bit, but I wasn't an amazing drummer, and I was a lot more gravitated towards the tech side. So basically out of thinking I can find a better job in audio than in music, I went towards the tech. So I ended up coming out of college with a fine arts degree, and then working for this sound company for about five and a half years after that. So that's where I met Scott. Our lighting guy at the time worked with his band, and he called my mom one day. I wasn't home. He's like, "Hey, is he any good?" And she said, "Well, yeah, he's good."
His mom says he was really good.
So thanks to my mom again for college and for this, you know. And I thought, oh, I hit it big. I'm going to mix Scott's bar band, and it was awesome. And we hung out a lot there, and I did that on the off times. Also, in the St. Louis area, we had house sound systems in about four venues there. And then, so I ended up being tech over that and working at the amphitheater there. And then just came to a kind of a transitional point in my life where it was like, this is all great, this is wonderful, but I just feel like something's missing. At that point, I was a Christian, but I hadn't really been following Christ, and just really did some soul searching and found out, you know, this secular audio thing isn't really where I'm supposed to be. So I just kind of dropped it at God's feet and said, I'm going to leave it. I ended up thinking I was going to become a music minister. Thank you, Jesus, I didn't. But no offense to music ministers, but this side's more my style. And then, so through that, I spent about a year and a half, got involved in a campus ministry in Kentucky, and little did I know, right across the river from where I lived all my life in St. Louis was a large church called Grace Church, and they called me up through a mutual friend and got the job there. Came in as a mixer, spent the first couple years doing that, and then moved into the technical director role. So for the last 14 years, been kind of off and on mixing, overseeing sound, lighting, staging, audio, everything. So it's been a really fun adventure there. Audio is definitely my passion, but there's also been the opportunity to dabble in a bunch of other areas to keep the interest up. So it's been a fun job.
You know, kind of what I discovered, I remember this in the last class, that, man, if you love mixing, you just hone your skills doing it anywhere and everywhere. I mean, it kind of sounds like everybody had that journey before you end up in the church. And I think there's something to be said just about that exact thing. I mean, what's cool is that I know when I was younger, the church really didn't have this. So I had no other choice but to do it, you know, in the world, quote unquote. But, and if you love to mix, whenever you can, your buddy's garage band, just get in there and do that, because it will give you skills. Moving on to the next question. And I like to, as I'm reading this, I like to preface it too, that it might just not be one piece of gear, but the question goes like, what's the one piece of gear you have to have at every event you would do? But I know as audio guys, we have toolboxes of things that sometimes we like to carry, and things that we consider paramount to us getting the mix right. Would there be something like maybe a couple things? It might not just be one thing.
Wow. You know, narrowing it down to one thing is really hard, because the whole thing about mixing is it's combining a lot of different things. Man, you know, I'm kind of at a point right now where I really want a really great band on stage, because, you know, you put a good band up there, and, I mean, yeah, I want this, but having a great band with, you know, not quite that in gear will get you a lot further, I think, than having a really great PA and console with a mediocre band. I mean, if you put a mediocre band through a, you know, a really clean system like the Meyer stuff in here, and you can hear how really mediocre they are. just cleans it all up for that. You know, after a band, I mean, I want a really good PA. Having a smart live rig is really nice because I can tell what's going on pretty fast without having to. I mean, it's always good to walk around and check things, but I can just looking at some things, I can go, oh, okay, I know what I'm gonna. Some things I'm probably gonna start dealing with, and then beyond that, man, I just love having the Avid venue as a console because there's just so many. I mean, talk about the Swiss Army knife of digital desks. I can do just about anything with it. So.
And I think all three of you are on that particular mixing platform, aren't you? Yeah. Except me, that's okay.
I'm not. I used to be. That's not how it works. We're heading that direction. For me, I felt like, you know, obviously I would echo exactly what Dave said about venue, about a great band. Very tangibly, in the last year and a half or 2 years, I've really put a lot of focus on reinvesting in my own toolbox, you know, my case that I carry with me everywhere I go. There's some particular things that I have in there. I make sure I have a drum key. I make sure I have some, you know, I have some of the moon gel. I have a drum dial now because, man, some of the guys I'm working with, hey, the drums just need a little tweak. And again, before I can do anything back there, I got to get it right up here. And so in a coach role, that's, you know, one of those ways that I can help. Making sure you have your own tools so when something breaks, I can fix it way faster if I have my own soldering iron that I've done a bunch of stuff with. Because in every case, when it breaks, it's breaking at the worst time possible, and everybody's waiting on you. And so, you know, those sort of things, specifically having a smart rig, getting some type of a tool, some type of a way that you know that you can, you know, whatever that is, whether that's just an RTA. Man, back in the day, I used to just have one of those ringing RTAs that had the three lights, and even that was enough to, you know, to help you a little bit. And an SPL meter that you can trust, just for sake of, again, knowing where you're at.
You didn't leave anything for me. No, I totally, everything you guys said, I would agree with completely. Just to add to that, BSS 901 Dynamic EQ is from working in the church.
Or Serato.
Yeah.
I have there. Some of those if you want to buy them.
Oh, really? I've got three. I don't really need them. But,
sorry.
We use the C4 now, but it works okay. The 901's great, especially in the church, because just the different styles of vocals. Screechy vocals is one of the main things that you're going to get complaints about. And you just dial in a little bit in the 2 to 4K, 2 to 5K, and scoop that out when you need to, and you can do your work a lot easier without having to worry about that.
That's fantastic. I got a great story. Like when I was learning to mix, my parents were very forgiving. We set up JBL wedges in my mom's living room, and he had a 31-band EQ, and we were learning frequencies. Smart didn't exist. And Ron was probably one of the most amazing guys to me because we rang monitors out on wedges all the time, and he could hear. We'd be out there, you know, doing all the strange noises on the microphone. I don't see people do it a whole lot anymore. But making the feedback happen, and he would, you know, pull down 800, pull down 2K. We were firing off feedback in my mom and dad's living room so I could learn frequencies. And I still got a picture of her. I'm sure they were very appreciative of that. But an old story of how much we were into trying to get our craft down. Let's go to this next question. So we're going to talk about outboard gear and plugins, and what's your philosophy on using just enough gear to make it sound great, but not too much where you lose the magic of the original sound? So this is kind of like that question about the art of mixing.
Yeah, I don't use any plugins.
Wow, you bought the venue and you just don't use any plugins.
Some people know me. You know, the thing for me with plugins and all that kind of stuff, if I'm adding something to a sound, it really should be making it better. And, you know, I try and get down on the stage and listen to what's going on, what am I getting, what are my sources. I walk around the drum kit every week. If we've got guitar amps, we put guitar amps in, isolation boxes. I'll go back in there, check the mics, make sure everything's positioned right, and kind of get everything set up on stage first. Then I can start playing around, you know, in the console if I have to do something. And really, it's got to make it better, because otherwise, what's the point? And You know, I'll A-B things a lot and pop things in and out and see what's this doing. Is it better or worse? Because we've just got so many options available to us. It can almost be overloading at some point. And I mean, just this past week, I was working with one of our volunteers and he had dialed something in and I went, okay, well, let's see if we can try some different things. And we ended up going right back to where he was just from going through there. Because if it doesn't get better, then we don't really need to put it on there.
Yeah, I would echo right on that. And the journey of when I started at Kensington, we had a PM1D. We sold it and moved a venue. And the journey through that process for probably 6 months before we actually had the venue in the room, you know, I'm using the software, and Dave and a few guys are sending me show files, and I'm just trying to absorb everything that I can about it. And I would say the most dangerous part about, especially plugins nowadays, is there's so much information out there. Like for me, it was real easy in the early days to put something on it because I saw that's what someone else put on it. And I didn't necessarily know why. I didn't know what it did. But that's what I saw on a show file, and so that's what I tried. And so the most important thing to me is to know your tools. Whatever the plugins are that you... So, you know, my journey with the venue was to spend a season and really learn a certain plugin. You know, spend a season and really learn what Rain Serato would do and when you use it and when you wouldn't, whether that's in virtual soundcheck or whether that's in a rehearsal or whatever the case. But I got caught with my pants down a few times where the music director comes back and he's reviewing the mix with me at the end of the night and he's like, man, something doesn't sound quite right there. And all of a sudden we're soloing down and it ends up being a plugin or something that I had in the chain that I didn't even realize I had in the chain. Even some plugins, they add noise or they add a character, even if you really have them, you know, turned down where in theory they shouldn't be affecting the signal, they do. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm kind of caught with egg on my face that I had something in place that was, as soon as we turned it off, all of a sudden, wow, that, you know, that's what that drum should sound like or whatever the case is. So that's the delicate line that we balance nowadays is, you know, what Dave said, you have all these options. You really have to be careful because you can do so much more harm than good. We can take music so technical that we lose just the art and the magic of it. It's scary when I just did this, you know, just did this event and I was on the venue again. I've been away from it for 7 months on M7s and went back for this event. And, you know, I went back to some of the old processes and the old chains and the old things that I did that I was used to doing. It's scary because in that world, you can get yourself into a hole real fast because you don't realize what something is affecting, you know, that's down buried in a layer or something like that. So you just have to be really careful to keep the magic of the music. At the end of the day, our job is to make it sound better. And if you don't, we're not benefiting anything.
Yeah, I agree. Like what Dave said, I think it all starts on the stage. Spend a lot of time up there making sure everything's correct and making sure that it's getting back to you clean. And then, really, even before I start putting in the plugins, I dial things up a little bit. And I can see where everything sits. Does it replicate what I was hearing off the stage? Does it, what could I add to fatten something up or to thin something out or to control something? But trying to make sure I use a plugin for a purpose. And not one of the things we find, and I've got other guys mixing too, but we'll just leave a plugin chain in, and just because it's there and it's in the preset. And, you know, sometimes just zeroing that out, starting from just the plain channel strip, and then adding in the different plugins as you hear the necessity. And, I mean, it all comes back to listening. You know, listen on stage, listen to just the channel, listen when you put in the first plugin, A-B it, like Dave said, on-off. Is it really adding something? Is it making it more musical? Is it fitting it into the mix? And then decide, yeah, I'm going to use it, instead of, oh, I just want to use this new plugin. The other thing is that we try to stress is using the virtual sound check, spending time offline, really figuring out what these plugins do, so that you have kind of your go-to plugins. Say you're out on a one-off and you got to slam a mix together. You have a very short time to put it together. Well, okay, I know this compressor, and this EQ, this delay. these things are going to work for me, they're going to do what I want them to do, and I can make it happen quick. So just practicing offline and make it fun. You know, if you can record your band multi-track and play it back, do it that way. If not, you know, get a couple friends to come over and play live. Anything. I mean, back in the when I first started at Grace, we used to play CDs and try to mask sounds and spend enormous amounts of time, maybe a little bit over the top. But it was a great starting place, because now if you hear something, I'm always calling down to the guy mixing, like, hey, you know, check your plug-in chain. What do you got going on? I feel something kind of squeezing a little bit. Well, he's got the on-channel compressor going. And he's got another limiting compressor, you know, a little just making sound. Well, it's too much. So always start from simple.
Yeah, I mean, I think a great example of what we're talking about, I don't know how many people got to be in my last breakout, but that band that was on the stage, I know Ron, who was mixing them, he had no plugins, he had no outboard gear of any kind, and the sound was amazing. And I heard a story about a guy that was mixing the Eagles, and the opening band, the young engineer with the young band, had all this outboard gear inserted in all the channels and whatnot, and the Eagle sound guy came out, took it all off, brought the main key things in front of him, and the show sounded amazing. And I think it goes back to what you were saying, a great band. I think our tools a lot of times, and what gets frustrating for me as a sound engineer, is I'm grabbing things to fix things I don't want to have to fix. When you have a great source, you don't have to use a lot of this stuff. And that's that partnership and being a great player and getting great tone. And so I don't have to come and over-EQ something or squash it with a compressor, because all those tools, sometimes they're a shaping tool for a sound. I get that. But a lot of times in our world, we're trying to stop something bad from happening or correct something so it fits in the mix. So did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I was just going to say, a lot of the time, like, I mean, I will use a lot of plugins. But it's all stuff doing very little bits of things, and it's, you know, it's almost like using different sets of lenses to get different colors and slightly different tones on things to, you know, part of it is just to make everything kind of fit together, because I mean that the whole mixing thing is it's all about relationships between instruments. We're not, you know, just getting single sounds together. We've got to, you know, take, you know, in a lot of places, it's a lot of stuff up on stage and cramming into, you know, come out of one or two speakers. But, you know, for me, it's like I am very privileged to work with great musicians, and a lot of times it's just a little bit on top here and there versus, you know, not, like, trying to fix things.
A little goes a long way.
Yeah, it's just, I have a really hard time, like, I can't fix something if it's bad to begin with. I mean, there's some things you can do sometimes. I mean, sometimes you
think,
what, man, that is the greatest plug-in of all time. The mute, the fader all the way down, those things, that does wonders for mixers sometimes. Less is more. But anyways, see, and now you just threw me.
I didn't know that was our secret. There's a lot of stuff up there, though.
Yeah, it's just, but it's little stuff. I mean, just you got to get it right at the source first.
And I was just going to piggyback off of the last session that, especially in this context, the relationship between that you have in the back with the guys on stage is everything to being able to get the most out of them. You know, because especially, man, the guitar tone stuff, the drum tuning stuff, being able to have the relationship, I've always made that a really high priority when you come in, to gain the band's trust so that you can be a partner with each other, because that's everything to getting the, you know, to getting the tone, to getting that stuff, because if it's right here, it makes your job out there so much easier.
All right, Ron, you good? You good? Awesome. So there's kind of a trick question thrown in here, and it was just kind of to get the response to it. So you walk into a gig, and the rental house sent you a Mackie and some old compressors. And this wasn't on the rider, so what do? And lighting the board on fire is not an option.
Why are you looking at me, man?
It could be simple. You just make it work.
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go talk to my client. Because there's some expectations that are going to need to be set on things. If it's a situation where I can't walk away or don't want to walk away, It's just, you know.
You had a good response to that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like a perfect example is, you know, maybe I come in on Sunday morning and over the weekend somebody liberated our front of house console and all I can find is, you know, the Behringer that was down in the kids' room that has, you know, 5 channels that work or something like that.
Nobody's relating.
No, I doubt it. You know, at that point, it's about prioritizing things. You know, what do I actually need to put in the PA? Because if I'm in a smaller room, I might be able to get a lot. You know, like a perfect example, that room we were just in for the last breakout, which was a small room. You had drums on stage. You had some amps on stage. Well, I can put that stuff up out there, you know, ask the drummer to play with plastics or hot rods or something like that and tone that down, pull the shield off. Get a bass amp, a guitar amp, you can get those positioned on stage. You could probably get away with just putting a vocal out in the room and doing that. You know, then we're doing sound reinforcement where we're reinforcing what's coming off the stage and not trying to do this like CD kind of mix coming through the PA. And of course there would be a channel for the senior pastor. That would be.
We actually had that happen. It was our last weekend on an old PA before we were about to change it out. We come in to do a line check on Saturday morning, and there's next to nothing coming out of the PA. And coincidentally, a whole bunch of Crown Macro techs had all failed all at the same time. And band rehearsal's going to start in an hour or two, and you're just in troubleshooting mode of what are we going to do? What gear can we pull? What can we pull from where to make it work? What's the bare minimum? And that's what I would say. At the end of the day, our job is to make it work and to, you know, the show has to go on. The service has to go on, whatever the case is, hopefully with as little disruption as possible. I'd say in that moment, communication is really, really important when something's going left to make sure that the band knows what's happening, the client, the senior pastor, your producer, or whoever it is, just to be communicating through that whole process because normally they can be your advocate and everyone else will have a lot of patience when you're saying, I'm doing everything I can, here's the plan, here's what we're going to do, stay calm, and at the end of the day, we just have to do what it takes.
Yeah, I think I'd first check with the production company, see what we could get. If you can't get anything else, then it just becomes a big amount of compromises. Definitely get the right people on your side so that they know what's happening, so the you know, there's going to be places you're going to have to cut corners. And then put the compressors on the channels that you need them on the most, and use your ears. We've had that happen at Grace. We had an XL, which was it, 200 or the 3 or something, and it was a demo, and then the shed next door, they had one die, and then so the demo company wanted to rent it to them, so they gave us a Allen and Heath little GL3000 or 3300, and it was on a Saturday. We were already just about to start rehearsal, and you have to slap it together, and you have to focus as much as you can, and mix.
Those are all great questions because I like prioritizing this would be so huge in that moment, obviously, and having the relationships to realize that look, this is where we're at, this is what we got to do, and. It's not going to be optimal, but, you know, and then we discuss after the service what went wrong and how to fix it.
Yeah, we're not using that production company.
This one, I'm going to throw at you, and I think as a benefit to everyone, again, who's on this road to becoming a sound engineer and things that we all personally do, and the question is, how do you ensure that you're continuing to grow as an engineer and not just falling into predictable mixing patterns? So, you know, just the whole growth thing, staying fresh.
Well, for me, I've got, like, a lot of other engineers I talk to and try and trade stuff around. Like, I'm always bugging Scott for stuff, and I steal stuff from Scott. I steal stuff from everybody. I don't know that I've come up with much original in ways of doing things. It's just, you know, I read a lot. I go back, and I listen to a lot of board mixes, and for me, I like listening to them, like, much later on when I'm disconnected to when they were actually done, because if I can separate myself emotionally, I can be a little more objective from it. And sometimes I've been surprised sometimes at hearing that. It's like, I go, oh, wow, who makes that? Huh, that's perfect. Oh, is that me? No. And a lot of times I'll compare kind of the stuff I'm doing right now to what I was doing then, and, you know, I probably change out a lot of microphones a lot and just try, like, I'm just constantly trying a lot of new things and, you know, just try not to, to get stuck in a rut. But, I mean, it all comes back to just push up the fader and what do you hear, and really just kind of, I mean, I think there's always an urge to reach and grab a knob, because knobs are fun. And you just have to listen and try and stop yourself from turning things when you don't need to.
I'm the same way. I'm constantly reading blogs, video stuff, listening to DVDs. I love listening to live concert DVDs and just getting the feel for what's out there. Obviously, going and shadowing. All along the way in my journey, I've always been blessed that I feel like God has led me towards guys that I can look up to, that I can watch, that I do exactly what you said. There's very little that you do that's original. It's usually your combination of whatever things. I remember the first time I sat and shadowed Scott, and I saw some stuff of what he was doing, and oh, that's a good idea, and came back and tried it, and it worked for us. And so over time, that just grows. I would say as far as improving the mix, man, the biggest growth period that I feel like I ever went through was when I started actively recording every mix I did, like he said, reviewing it after the fact once you're disconnected. My wife makes fun of me for it because sometimes I'll wear her out to death listening to something, you know, after the fact, even a few weeks later, especially if we've done a holiday production or something where we've been living in the music for 2 or 3 months and then I won't let it die, you know, later. But you learn so much about what things were translating, and you start learning how you hear in the room versus what was actually coming out of the speaker. And so you can adjust to that, you can adapt. So I would say that was the most important thing. And then once you have those mixes, man, being able to compare them to I learned a lot from the other guys who were mixing, and being able to listen to their stuff and then compare it to mine and the things that I liked. Hey, how can you do that? And, you know, we all just share and have synergy because it's all, you know, we're all a team. We're all trying to get better. And so that's been the biggest thing that I'm pouring into the guys now is, man, focus on the fundamentals. The fundamental stuff, as far as I'm concerned, never changes. A compressor is a compressor. They might have different characters or whatnot, but the most important thing off the bat was to learn how a compressor works, learn how a gate works, learn how the attack and release, how does it affect, learn your frequencies, learn that stuff. All those fundamentals never change. And so once you know those, now you're only going to get better and better at that.
Agreed. Reading a lot and listening to a lot of different styles of music, practice, a lot of virtual sound check, a lot of experimentation with different mics. What are the characteristics of these mics? What are they going to add or take away from the sound? And then getting to talk with other engineers is always really valuable. I had a chance, I was mixing in the front of house for a Joyce Meyer conference, and I got to mix the first night, but then they brought their engineer in the second night. So that was a really educational, wow, okay, I set this up, and then he's switching, and he had come in, and we were talking about it, but it was a really interesting experiment of, okay, this is what I hear. He's with the band all the time. And then what are the subtle changes that he did? You know, and take notes off that stuff. Write stuff down. Go back and practice it. Go back and try to implement those things into the way you approach it. And then I think just getting time with your band on stage, on the rehearsals, really listening to everything you do. Don't just dive in, okay, 250 and 2K, you know, are the problem areas. So, you know, listen to what you're doing. Listen before and then, you know, dial around. Really be meticulous about how you set everything up. And I think, the more you do that, the more you can get into the finer details. And like Dave was saying, then you can add in all the plugins and just do the subtle changes to your taste.
One of the things that just struck me hearing, just even the conversations we're having, is You know, we've all kind of talked about trying lots of different things. Well, you know, when I was at Kensington, man, we had a really nice selection of mics. We had a lot of different options, a lot of different flavors. Now I'm in a place that's not as established. We don't have the same kind of inventory. We don't have the same kind of resources. And so now I'm having to either draw on that experience, but more than anything, that's where the network of people that I can trust who can help point me in the direction. Because, again, I can't afford to go out and buy five different vocal mics that I can try, but I can probably buy one or two once I get it narrowed down. Wireless is that way. Again, being able to have a resource of guys that you trust when you're in the situation that you don't have that same kind of budget, I think that's what's worked for me.
Something else I was just thinking about, too, something that has always helped me is there's two types of people who I kind of want to get feedback from, and I'm real picky about who gives it to me, because I want positive, like, not positive feedback, but constructive criticism of things I'm doing. So I want feedback from, you know, guys who are like me, who think like audio guys, who can get real specific and, you know, yeah, I think you had a little too much 3K and stuff like that. But I also like getting feedback from people who aren't musicians and aren't techies, who, because that's the majority of the people who are sitting out in the seats and listening anyways. And, you know, a lot of times they can help with seeing if you're in the ballpark, because they're not going to, it's like, yeah, it was good. It's like, oh, I think, you know, that girl, she's too loud when she sings. And, you know, you just get little simple things, but you can, it can help kind of steer you in. Because, I mean, for me, that anyways, that's really the, well, I'm mixing for the people who pay me. But, you know, in the end, it's you know, your audience out in the seats, they're the ones who are going to be listening. So what do they think?
Especially the girlfriend or wife of the guitar player.
Oh, yeah.
I don't or the best of him.
Well, some, yeah, well, sometimes...
I'm just playing.
Hey, but, you know, it's true, though. Sometimes you have to mix to your pastor's taste.
Well, that's true, too.
It's a, you know, what we do mixing, it is a service gig, ultimately. It's, you know, I mean, I have my own taste, and I have my own way of, you know, I like things to sound, but at the end of the day, it's not just about my opinion.
I think one thing in the world of mixing, too, is our tools have changed. It's been a new paradigm. Is you ever get the comment, your mix looks really good. And what I'm talking about is you're seeing your EQ now on a screen and pulling your head out of what the plugin is looking like and keep listening. You know what I'm saying? Sometimes we kind of start option overload, getting into the visual of what's happening now instead of listening. That's kind of been an interesting thing, too, I've seen with analog desks. When you're turning them out, you're not looking at anything, you're listening. And now we're seeing a big screen in front of us, which is pulling our focus on, why is the bell curve so freaking big? It sounds right. Why is the bell curve so big? You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes it looks whack.
Yeah.
On screen. But, I mean, if it sounds good in the end, and it's not feeding back, and no one's complaining, or... the important people aren't complaining. Who cares?
Hey, looking at the last couple of questions, I think we've really kind of nailed a lot of that, because I definitely wanted to leave time for Q&A. We're going to run out of time if I don't. So let's just go right to Q&A. I'd love any questions you guys have, you know, for these guys. Anything at all. Anything you're struggling with, you're dealing with, you want to talk about, go for it.
I'll go first. We do a lot of sitting with them and actually walking through everything. I like to sit back and let them go for it and then say, what were you doing there? Or why'd you do that? Just explain that to me. And, you know, in the beginning, a lot of times, like, I don't know. It doesn't seem right. But, you know, so we sit with them a lot and we give them a lot of feedback, a lot of critique. But, you know, really trying to stay positive, but steer them in the direction that, you know, of the mix we want.
Depending on the skill level of the guy coming in, that will really affect that as well. I've had some guys, you know, as I've been new into this position, you have the established guys who have been doing this a long time and can get a really good product. Well, in that case,
again, I'm just over their shoulder, I'm listening, and just giving that feedback. Early on, it was important for me to mix quite a bit more than I am now, even 6 or 7 months later. I kind of tried to pattern, okay, here's where the sound is going, and the flip side of that is lots and lots and lots of vision. Really trying to communicate to the team of here's where we're going, here's the values for a mix, here's the values of what our sound will be, and casting that vision just over and over and over again. So people, my goal is every guy standing behind the console knows that we're an electric guitar driven. If the electric is not playing a hook, then it's going to be keys or acoustic or something like that. But the worship music we're doing, 95% of it is electric driven. So I want them to know that. I want them to know that, you know, our values are about the relationships with kick and bass. And those are the value of where we're going to put the lead vocal versus the BGVs. The lead vocal is always going to be out front. The BGVs are tucked behind. If there's a bunch of girls, we don't want it to sound, there's very rare, we want a whole big girl sound. We're trying to kind of tuck them back behind. I want them to know those 4 or 5 values we established them real early so that everybody can be on the same page. It's been really unique though, with some younger guys, newer guys to mixing. I've even found myself in a situation, I've got one guy in particular who's a really gifted musician, he's got a really good ear. But he's never mixed behind an M7, he's done some analog stuff. So for a few months, him and I would mix the service together. He's on one side, I'm on the other. I'm really doing the majority of getting the mix going. And once we get into the service, I have him pushing solos, I have him basically mixing the band, I'm mixing the vocals, and I have a hand on the DCAs. So at the end of the day, I'm the one that's going to cover his mistakes. Well, then over time, I start doing less and less. And it really took 4 or 5 times, and by that 4th or 5th time, he's doing the majority of it. Maybe I'm just riding the lead vocal and something like that. And we're real close to the point where he's about to fly solo. It's all relationships and communication, setting those values, and then each person, it almost seems like they kind of have their own language of what they need in order to, you know, in order to get the best out.
Yeah, I think training mixing is really, really difficult, because the thing about mixing, for me anyways, is that it's much more a musical discipline than a technical discipline. You can't, you know, give somebody a checklist, turn this knob to here, and then push this to here, you know, the China marker on the desk of where everything's supposed to be set. It doesn't work like that, because the thing about mixing is it's all about how your different sources all come together and blend together and making them kind of work together. You know, you put up a vocal, well, if I put a guitar up with that vocal, what does that guitar do to the vocal? Everything affects everything. So, you know, the thing that's hard for us doing audio versus the musicians on our stages, the musicians, they can take their music and they can take a demo tape and they can go home and they can drive everybody in their house nuts practicing over and over and over and over again. But for most of us, we get, you know, maybe we get a midweek rehearsal. For a lot of guys, you know, if you're doing a Saturday and Sunday service, you get sent, you know, Saturday afternoon and then Sunday, and then it's over. And to get better at an instrument, you've got to practice, 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 practice. So, you know, virtual sound check and the ability to do that, I think, is a priceless tool for church audio techs, because it's an ability to slow everything down and to back up and really listen without the pressures of the music director wants the sopranos, and the sopranos have to come up now. They've got to come up now, 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 now. You don't have any of that. And you can sit down and go, okay, hey, let's try that. No, that's not working. And you can really slow down and work on things. I think it's also good for guys to, you know, sometimes, you know, my buddy Chris Briley, who has mentored me and is now our production director at one of our campuses, you know, he has had a saying to me that sound guys, sometimes when they get behind a desk, go deaf. And you don't hear the forest, all you hear are these individual trees, and it's really hard to hear that. But sometimes if you can pull people out of that and actually listen, you know, if someone mixes and they didn't, you know, hit where you wanted them to be, and you've got a reference of where you wanted it, and then you've got what they just did. Sometimes when you play those back-to-back for people, they go, oh, those vocals are hot. You know, or, wow, that's a lot of hi-hat. So you can, you know, that kind of stuff, being able to kind of disconnect from the kind of adrenaline rush of, you know, doing the service, doing the rehearsal, you know, when you've got 20 people waiting on you, I think can really help.
Oh, and I'm going to be probably the bad guy here. There's a, I heard this explained the other day, I really liked it. He said, like, let's say you're doing something on a console and every one of your movements is recorded by a video camera. And later on you had to come back and justify what you did. And I got that because when you go to turn a knob, where are you going? Like, you got to know where you're going before you turn the knob. And that's kind of like the art of mixing. And I totally believe in giving people a chance, but I also look at mixing as something that can't be taught. You either got it or you don't. And I think he discovered in the process of giving people chances. But I always use an analogy of two white canvases, put the same paintbrush and paint in front of each one, put Picasso in front of one, put me in front of the other one. I cannot paint the picture that band's going to paint with the same tools because it's not in me. And I look at mixing the same way. You just get it. Music, to paint the picture of music, it's a talent. It's something that's in you. And I think you can get better, but some people I don't think will ever be able to mix. I have to be fair about that.
Yeah, I would kind of tend to agree with that a little bit. I think the guys who do have potential, though, it's definitely, you have to kind of coach them more. And, you know, and something, too, that's good is it's always good to start with something that was good. I mean, there's always something, I think, I hope, that was good. And start there, and then you can move to, I think you should work more on this, and here's a specific area that I think you need to focus in at one period of time. Like, I think your vocals need some work. So spend, you know, the next 3 months just focused in on getting the vocals really, really good within the context of the mix. And then you can move on to, okay, let's get the kick and the bass relationship really, really good and get that to work.
And, you know, the original question was, how do you do this through a team and through volunteers or whatever? And that's where, like, you know, setting that goal for your team. As a team, we're going to work on vocals. We're going to be working on, you know, and so everybody's kind of able to talk to each other and start having that kind of peer mentoring thing going on. That's been really successful as well.
All right, and I'm going to encourage everybody, too, to grab any of us in the hallway for those hallway conversations if you need to get real specific with anybody. Again, that's what Gurus is about. Any other questions? Go for it.
Mixing mono is really, really difficult. And if you've got a 12-singer, you know, praise team and three keyboards and four guitars and a drummer and a perk player, and we're going to add loops because everybody's using loops now too, it's really hard to get that stuff to get enough space in a mono system. It can be done, but it takes a lot longer, I think, and it's a lot harder to do. The band that was always the easiest, like the easiest thing I ever did was I mixed the Fee band maybe a year and a half ago for just a student thing, and it's, you know, it's bass guitars and drums and a couple of vocals, and those guys, everybody is playing in their spot, because you know the other side of that is the band has to be arranged. You can't have, if you've got three people playing the exact same note, one of them is going to win, in theory, and you're going to pick the winner. So you've got to have that arranged, and those guys were just, everybody is just got this little pocket that they naturally sit in, you know, on a good PA, and you just kind of push up faders and go, wow, this is kind of cool, and go from there. But I think, you know, a lot of times, if you can simplify what you're trying to mix, that'll help a lot. Otherwise, I think everybody's got to be prepared. It's going to take a while.
That's where a good relationship with your music director helps a lot, or with the band, to be able to talk. A lot of times, I've got a great relationship with our band, and they're great players, and it's a great thing to mix. But every once in a while, we have two keyboard players. They'll be playing on top of each other, and just a quick either run up the stage. Usually I like to do it face to face. Hey, you guys are playing the same thing. Can you mix it up? Here's what he's doing. And then boom, all of a sudden, whoop, they come off of each other. And you know, it opens up the sound. And you didn't change anything on the console. It was just all about asking them.
Okay, guys. Well, time's up. Got to get ready for the next thing in this room and be conscious of the team here. So again, grab any of us in the hallway. We'll be glad to answer anything you want. And hopefully you had a great time. We'll see you.